Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. They're like, would you like to see my boobies? Like that kind of thing.
I keep them in this briefcase right here. Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From Portland, Oregon, you are Richard Wally.
And from California, you are Cassidy Robinson from the Garden Grove.
For a little bit longer, yeah.
Oh, yeah, you're looking for the L.A. happenings.
Yep, I'm moving up. Moving on up. Well, not really. I'm moving north, but as far as my living standards go, they're going quite south.
Fair enough.
I'm pretty sure. I don't know.
You're moving further beyond the poverty line.
Right, right. I mean, I don't know. This is like an SAT question to try and figure out, like a math problem of like, how do I live on the West Side and pay less than $700 a month and not live in a ghetto and live with people who aren't completely insane?
Well, you're in the wrong city for that. I mean, clearly. Right.
Oh, I've met some people, Richard.
That's exciting.
Oh my, I'll get to it. Today we're gonna be reviewing Mad Max Fury Road, which we were both very excited to see. And at the end of the episode, we're going to be reviewing They Came Together, which we were supposed to review with Leland when he was on, but he had to skedaddle real fast. And since I haven't watched The Hunt yet, we're going to go ahead and just take care of They Came Together this week. So, some of these adventures.
These characters.
I'm starting to believe normal people don't actually exist in LA. They just don't.
So, I mean, I can't say anything. I really can't.
Well, you live in Portland.
Yeah.
But there's kind of like a folksy, homesy, bearded, besweatered kind of weirdness that's a little bit more endearing than like the shyster crazies that live in L.A.
with cocaine and all that kind of crazies coming at you.
And yeah, bizarre. I met this person Friday. I'd emailed her, I'd texted her, whatever, to go see this place. Her and her boyfriend are sharing up in Sherman Oaks, which is a little bit north of Hollywood. A little further away than I would like to be from where I'm going to be working, but not the worst situation driving-wise that I've been to. And I went there, and I met her, and she, you know, kind of like a little bit kind of a, I don't know, she could have just like woken up or whatever and just had her hair up, but I kind of got like sort of a crunchy granola vibe from her.
Sure.
But also in a very LA way, not in a Portland Northwest kind of way. So she's showing me around the house, and before I even knock on the door, I hear dogs, little dogs, like barky little dogs.
Sure.
And so immediately I'm red flagging in my head, like, oh God. Okay, so we'll put that in the negative column. She opens the door. The dogs eventually settle down. I look at the room. It's whatever. It's as good or as bad as most of the ones I've seen. At least had some closet space. And then we get into the interview process, which is more than I get most of the time with these people.
Mm-hmm.
And she, right out of the gate, asks me if I snore or if I have a snoring problem.
Okay.
And I honestly couldn't answer the question like well enough because I didn't know like. She's like, yeah, we have very thin walls here, and you know, she's really, really concerned about being woken up. Which makes me nervous anyway, just because then, like, I'm walking on eggshells around the house at night.
Sure.
But she's like, yeah, over the phone, she was like, are you going to be starting coffee in the morning? Because coffee can wake people up. It's like, no, I don't really do that. If, you know, if I get anything, I just, you know, get it on the way to work or whatever. And she's like, okay. And that seemed like the only caveat at that point. But now snoring is the big issue.
Okay.
And she's asking me this as I'm staring at her three tiny dogs who are pittering around the house.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like openly just like vaping in the house while she's conducting this interview. So in my head, I'm a little bit like, okay, so, right. I'm building a character profile. And
gotcha.
I can't answer the question exactly. So I'm like, yeah, I don't think so. And she's like, well, why? Well, it's a yes or no. Like, I feel like I'm in trouble in the first 5 minutes of this interview. And she's like, well, you should ask people and then get back to me about it. I'm like, okay, I guess I'll do that. And then the interview keeps going. It's, by this point, it's not even an interview anymore. We're just having, like, I guess, casual conversation. And she's, like, an oversharer.
Happens, yeah, okay.
And definitely one of those type of people who likes to hear themselves talk. Apparently, she's been on two reality shows.
Ooh.
And when I informed her that I don't really follow reality, I was like, oh, that's cool. I don't really follow reality TV. Like, she was kind of, like, visibly, like kind of annoyed by that response.
Sure.
And then we got into the discussion because I told her what I do. I'm working at the Wrap. And, you know, I was talking about how, like, the other weekend the cast of Silicon Valley came in to take pictures. And I was kind of, like, just trying to focus in and do my work without freaking out.
Mm-hmm.
And she started talking about herself in regards to the celebrity world. Like, you know, we don't mind if we're approached every once in a while, as long as you like that.
Hmm.
And my favorite thing she ever said, or maybe that anyone's ever said to me in a while, and I went in completely out of body experience mode where I'm just like watching myself have this interview with this person observing this strange creature I've met. It's like the most stereotypically like LA person thing to say. She said, yeah, if we're out in public and you see us, like, it's really weird when you're around someone and you know they recognize who you are, but they pretend like they don't. It's like creepy.
Hmm. Okay.
Not just that they don't recognize her legitimately. It's that they clearly do. And are not saying something. And not giving.
So do you think she was like directing this at you?
Possibly. It could have been a jab. And also just pure narcissism. She also told me a story about how she apparently met Joey McIntyre of New Kids on the Block at a club she was a go-go dancer at. And then like fucked him that night. And then later found out he had a fiance. And it ruined her fantasy forever.
Cool, I guess.
Went on like for an hour and 20 minutes. And I barely got a word in. Needless to say, we'll not be living there.
But why not?
Well, I texted Keith. Apparently I do snore.
Yeah, you do.
Were you going to confirm that for me?
Yeah, I was going to tell you.
You should know that you do snore.
You know, just for possible interviews.
Right. And
she's really, really... Like it's strange to me how like crazy she was about the sleep stuff.
Right.
Like she probably needs at least like 14 hours of sleep every day, I'm going to assume.
Or
she's part of her regimen.
Or she goes out at night a lot and won't sleep through the day. Like, I don't know the whole sitch.
Fair enough.
I've come to realize that people in LA have like a job kind of, but they make most of their money from some sort of hustle.
Yeah, you know. Yeah, it sounds about right.
So I have my job. I'm still looking for my hustle.
Yeah. What are you? Is it going to be drugs? Is it going to be human trafficking?
Maybe not. Hopefully, I can just like freelance on the side.
Well, I mean, you said your hustle. I was just saying.
Right.
You're probably not the right gender for human trafficking, though.
Well, then let's go ahead and get into the show. And we're backed up on news, and if anyone's following us on Facebook, facebook.com/jabberpodcast, you can look at several stories that we're not going to cover, because, you know, when you don't do this for like 2 weeks, we generally end up with like 9-10 stories, and we have to only pick maximum 4 to fit into the show. So it's a good place to look at stories as they're developing and see what we may end up talking about, what we may not end up talking about. But what do you have first thing?
My first thing is, this is one of the older ones, but I found it interesting. So Louis C.K., he's going to write, direct, and star in a new film called I Am a Cop.
I'm assuming he's a cop in this movie.
Well, yeah, I'm going to assume. I don't know, though. So let's not make any presumptions, any wild speculations like that.
Mm. Assumptions are fine. Presumptions, no.
It's supposed to be an indie film. I'm gonna maybe a comedy. I don't know. His versions of comedy sometimes kind of throw me for a loop. So
yeah, with him, it could go either way. It'll probably, no doubtedly, be a dark comedy.
Yeah. Well, is it going to be about the, you know, the current political situation, or is it going to be like his character on
Parks and Rec?
Parks and Rec.
That's,
I don't know,
immediately,
if you've seen
what came to my mind.
Me too. Is that character, because he's so, like, he just
awkward,
says exactly,
and yeah.
Well, he also says exactly like the most obvious things.
Mm-hmm.
This is the address of the direction to the place that you're living. You know, just says these really awkward statements, and so I don't know. I'm curious, mm-hmm. but again, I don't know what this is going to be, because he can definitely go into rougher territory.
Right, with the show and.
Well, besides his show recently on SNL, the people are kind of upset with him, apparently, because he made some jokes about racism and pedophilia, you know.
Right, right. Did you
really
watch
tame
the, did you watch the monologue?
I did watch the monologue. I thought it was funny.
Yeah, it's classic Louis C.K. Like, it's nothing off the grid of what he does all the time. It's just on network television, so it's going to get a few more eyeballs than he usually gets, you know, for his fans.
Mm-hmm.
And they might not be sympathetic eyeballs, but
well,
no, I thought it was funny. I mean, it kind of feels like he's done Saturday Night Live like a lot recently, because when every time he does an episode, the blogosphere has to post about it. But so he's probably already on the Five Timers Club. And every time he does a monologue, he just opens with stuff, you know, stuff he's working on, just stand-up.
Right.
Which, why not? You have one of the greatest stand-ups working now on the show. He might as well do some stand-up on the show. But I kind of feel like now he's done it so much that he's just kind of, like, working out material. Like, it's kind of unfinished. He's like, oh, let's see if these pedophile jokes, let's see how those go down. like how he normally would at, like, the, you know, a small club like the Laugh Factory or the Cellar.
Yeah.
But instead he's doing it on national television.
I think it was a good, no, he knew what he was doing, though. You saw that when, as soon as he said it and it came out of his mouth, the big stupid grin that came across his face.
Sure,
I was like,
sure.
Oh, he knows what he's doing.
Or maybe he got notes like prior saying specifically not to do those jokes, and so that was his like Sinead O'Connor tearing up the Pope moment.
Right, right. Which, you know, it every time that happens, though, on SNL, the executives make a big deal out of it, but it's like remembered as this
this big
lovable
moment.
Wonderful moment.
Yeah, it ends up in Time magazine or something.
Yeah, and now it's like, hey, I don't know, I didn't think anything he said was like,
no, I mean, I'm very used to his stand-up and you know, somewhat racy stand-up in general, so it didn't faze me, really. But anyway, this movie, it sounds cool. I'm excited for anything he's attached to, really, at this point. He hasn't done a movie, directed a movie, I don't think, since Pootie Tang.
Well, what's interesting about this, though, too, is he's kind of, I think, established kind of a routine and kind of has more of a directing and writing prowess than he did at the time that he did that movie as well, because he's been doing Louis for so long.
Brand.
What?
Like a personal brand.
Yeah.
Didn't have back then.
Well, and I think he can go as far as he would like.
Yeah.
So I'm excited to see it. But.
Cool. My first story. You know, there's a lot of horror remakes that are coming out. There's a lot of them.
Yeah.
And a lot of, you know, unnecessary reboots of franchises and blah, blah, blah. The only one that I've been consistently interested in, and I actually want to happen, and I actually care when news information comes out about it.
Sure.
Despite doing this segment on our podcast every week, is I anything I hear about the It remake, the Stephen King adaptation, because I think it's a great story, and I think it has a pretty bad to mediocre movie adaptation of it with one good central performance. But anyway, so the big piece of information I've been really excited to hear about is who's going to play Pennywise, because it's going to make or break this movie, whatever it is. Cary Fukunaga, is that his name? The guy who directed most of the episodes of True Detective last season?
Well, he directed all of the episodes. Right. That was the big hubbub about it, but yeah.
And he did the most recent Jane Eyre adaptation. And
did he? No.
Yeah, the one with Mia Wasikowska and Fassbender. Anyways, we're burying the lead. They've cast the... Pennywise, the clown, and he's going to be played by Will Poulter from the teenager from We're the Millers.
Yeah.
I mean, based upon what I've seen, mostly True Detective, I really trust this director, especially when it comes to how something is going to portray tonally and visually.
Sure.
So I have to believe that there was something in that audition and some card that this kid has in his pocket that was a wild card, something crazy, something that really blew his mind. Because I don't think, I mean, unless this is just like the world's biggest prank, I have to believe that there's something there. And I trust him. I didn't see We Are the Millers. I don't even know if I had seen it, if that would really affect how I feel about the story.
Well, I don't. Okay, here's my thing. Anytime you try to replace Tim Curry, it's a fool's errand. Just be honest. But beyond that, I guess my only hesitancy is, I don't know what they're doing specifically. So his age is a little weird to me, but maybe not. I have no idea, really. So, I mean, at this point, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really have a real opinion on it. It's just more as like, that seems like a strange choice.
Right. But I think there's two things that's kind of wise about this choice, or a choice like it. I can't really say much about the actor, but I think if you're going to try and recast something that's been as iconic as Tim Curry as Pennywise, then it should be as wildly different as possible. It should be completely on the other side of the spectrum. And so I think this casting very well kind of suggests that.
Also an unknown.
And an unknown. Someone who doesn't have a lot of clout and you're not going to be seeing through the makeup for the actor the whole time. Yeah.
Right.
And then the other thing is that, you know, the story of it being, you know, childhood friends and primarily children who are targeted by this creature, by this dark entity, maybe it's sort of interesting to have a younger take on the clown rather than an adult.
Maybe. I don't, I, again, this is just more of a, okay, we'll see. I think I'm a little more hesitant than you. It's not necessarily one of my favorite stories ever told or anything like that.
No, it is probably, I mean, as far as just the actual story goes, it is probably conceptually one of my favorite from Stephen King.
Well, I don't have a lot of pent up anything for it, but I think I actually find it more interesting because of that, because I don't have any preconceived notions, even because, I mean, I've seen the TV movie, but I mean,
yeah,
and it's like a TV movie.
It ruined me as a child, but I, you know, upon seeing it even like 5 years later, I was like, oh, this isn't very good.
Well, it was my first tiptoe into the tulips of horror for me, but
right. And a lot of people. Okay, what's your other story?
What is my other story? So that Nicole Kidman is going to be set into a movie that they're developing of the short story How to Talk to Girls at Parties. Now, this is a short story done by Neil Gaiman.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of horror.
Yeah, well, loosely urban fantasy
related. Yeah.
Yes. this is one of his more. This is actually one of his more humorous short stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually always am kind of interested when people take on a short story as opposed to a novel, because a short story you really have to expand and kind of pull out an idea. Whereas like a novel, you have to deduce and kind of confine an idea.
When adapting it for the screen. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So How to Talk to Girls is basically about this boy that goes to this party and he's just a dumb boy trying to understand girls. Mm-hmm. And basically the joke is he just doesn't get any of it, mm-hmm. but they're all kind of like aliens. So
it's kind of like a cross between like Perks of Being a Wallflower and like The World's End.
Somewhere, yes, that's actually a good like combination. Specifically, the way that they kind of are explaining it is Romeo and Juliet with punks and aliens.
Okay.
Nicole Kidman's in it somehow. I don't really know because it was all teenagers in the short story.
Right. Was there no mothers or?
No, it's literally like a teenage party. Okay. And it's from the kid's point of view, and he's just going around this party. Apparently, Gaiman does have quite a bit of influence in it. Mm-hmm. The director Mitchell and Philippa Goslett, they did Hedwig and the Angry Inch, are helping to develop.
That actually makes me vastly more interested in this project.
And then it says Fanning, but it doesn't say which Fanning.
I'm going to guess L.
I'm going to guess the
She's young been getting one. More roles recently.
Right.
And I think she had something come out in Cannes this weekend.
So, yeah. So, I don't know. It all sounds pretty interesting. And it is one of his more lauded short stories. Nicole Kidman would also be coming back into contact with
the director.
Mitchell Goslett of Rabbit Hole. So,
yeah.
It has some clout to it. And it sounds fairly interesting. And like I said, like, I don't know exactly where they're going to go with it, but I'm more excited because when you take a short story and you pull it apart that way, I think it has more of a range and can be more cinematic than trying to adapt a novel. So I am actually pretty excited for this. So
yeah, I'm down. And there's a little bit of a precedent for this kind of like supernatural teen thing, obviously, and then even with a comedy edge with like Dead Bodies.
Yeah.
And that kind of stuff. So maybe be kind of be playing in those waters. But I think John Cameron Mitchell is a slightly more experienced and sophisticated writer's director.
Yeah. Thoughtful, so, probably. More thoughtful. As
yeah.
Well.
And coming from Gaiman, I think it'll be a slightly higher grade than, you know, the Hot Topic pop rocks and coke that was Dead Bodies.
You're talking about Warm Bodies? The one with
Warm
the,
Bodies. That's right.
Whatever.
That movie.
Nicholas Holt? Mm-hmm. No, that's not it.
Yes, it was. And we'll was be talking it? About him later in the episode.
Okay, I got his name right all on my own. I didn't even have to use IMDb.
We are going to do a pet topic. We haven't done one in a little while. Today we're reviewing Mad Max Fury Road, which is a post-apocalyptic movie.
Mm-hmm.
You specifically, I think we both are, but I think you specifically are a very big fan of this genre.
I am.
Yeah. Post-apocalyptic thriller, action movie, drama, whatever you want to call it, science fiction.
Well, it's a big mix of a lot of things because you are taking elements of horror, you are taking the world building and other elements of fantasy, mm-hmm. and you kind of have this strange technology that usually exists or is a remnant of a previous land like science fiction. Yeah. So you have this really weird jumble of a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. Is that specifically what draws you? Is that kind of that sort of alchemy and like figuring out how much of each element are they going to use this movie or that movie?
Well, they usually, I mean, so, you know, the film we're going to be talking about, Mad Max, that really established the more cult phenomenon in cinema, at least.
Mm-hmm.
I have seen a lot of articles that say he's the, you know, he created the post-apocalyptic, which I'm sure there's a lot of sci-fi writers that would probably have some qualms with that. But,
I'm sure they would. I think there's a lot of filmmakers who would as well.
Yeah, I do too.
I would say, though, that he sort of solidified it. Like I think there were a lot of movies prior to Mad Max, specifically Road Warrior.
Yeah.
That were dealing in some of these elements or kind of circling this. But I think he sort of established with Road Warrior the quintessential standard that everyone kind of riffs on.
Well, yeah, I'm attracted to that kind of I guess, dark, maybe slightly nihilistic tone of the films.
Right, and the outlook of the political or social future of without living without a government and rules.
Well, basically, we I mean, most of them, how it got to the point is that humans live so horribly and so kind of haphazardly that we've destroyed the world, that we've gone back into a primitive dark age where might is right. And it's all our fault. And so that's what I like about them. You know, people get their faces blown off. There's nothing that deep about my reasons for liking them.
But I mean, I think even within that, you know, a kind of a pulpy setup, there's room for a lot of political allegory or social allegories, where you're talking about, like, you know, the different factions that kind of come to rise and what they look like and how power structures work. And, you know, it's all there. It's science fiction.
They always rise out of something. I mean, normally, if they're well thought out, they rise out of something that had already existed. Right. And so you're kind of getting like the bastard child of things that are already a part of our world.
Right. It becomes a mirror of something, some sort of allegory that you can talk about today.
And it is, I mean, honestly, it does like appeal to me in the same way, like, why, I mean, Planet of the Apes, it has a stupid premise. It really does. Apes have taken over the world.
Right. But I mean, a log line, yeah.
Yeah. But, well, if you take it on paper, even if written down, you'd kind of be reading this and be like, this is going to make a really silly, pulpy movie. Mm-hmm. But then you get into it and you get into the meat of it.
Yeah.
And it can be very, very, you know, smart. And I like it when people hide that kind of stuff to really pulpy, dumb stuff. It makes me happy to no end. So,
yeah.
Specifically, the post-apocalyptic kind of lends to that, I think, in general.
So... What I mean, without talking about the Mad Max movies, because I think we'll get into that with our review.
Sure.
What are some of your favorites? What are some you think are overlooked?
One of the early ones that's overlooked is A Boy and His Dog.
Mm-hmm.
It has Don Johnson in it, and it's like pre Miami Vice and all that kind of stuff. He's just this young. He's really just this, like, I think he's like 18-year-old kid.
Oh wow! Okay.
It's really, really super low budget, 70s film, but it kind of has that kind of like drive-in movie kind of vibe to it. Uh-huh. It literally has a scene where they're at a post-apocalyptic drive-in. there's something that I kind of sometimes feel lacking in a lot of post-apocalyptic stuff that they do. It has a talking dog. Uh-huh. I like that really bizarre element.
Talking dog.
Yeah, talking dog. Okay. He's telekinetic and he talks into your brain hole.
Okay, that's less weird than like if they put peanut butter in the, like they misereded the dog.
No, yeah. Okay. I mean, yeah, anyway. and then it also has some monsters, but then it has this really quirky underground society and it has this kind of dark humor that and the ending is really it might not be the most PC ending, but I always found it humorous and kind of fun. But that is a film that's come out pre Mad Max, very much in, you know, the weird episodic nature of those kind of films, and very much the weird costuming, everything like that. So I always found that film one that people kind of overlook and should kind of maybe go back to and kind of be like, okay, this is fun.
Mm. So a kind of antecedent to the Mad Max series or this type of genre.
Kind of both. So.
Another one that kind of goes pretty far back. I think it's one of the earliest adaptations of Richard Matheson's I Am Legend. Mm-hmm. Is a Vincent Price movie, The Last Man on Earth.
Right.
And it doesn't, I don't think it's nearly talked about enough in general. Like, it's a great Vincent Price performance. It's really moody and atmospheric. It reminds me a little bit of Night of the Living Dead and its minimalism, and its stark black and white kind of stuff. And that movie also was inspired by I Am Legend. A lot of movies have been. But I think the Vincent Price one is a lot of fun. And you see, again, you see those elements.
I'll be honest. I like the Charlton Heston one too.
Oh, the Omega Man?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I watched it. It was one I watched for nudity.
like recently, like last week.
Yeah. Like last week. I think I was much younger actually then, but then I got really sucked into it because it was super weird.
Yeah.
And like, I like the aesthetic that they're not trying. They've just got this like super thin makeup on, and it's mm-hmm. not really like.
It's seen as something of a camp classic.
Well, now, you have to kind of actually like use your imagination a little bit, which I think is kind of sort of sad that we don't have to do that anymore.
Right. Well, unless the CGI is just that bad, and a lot of the times it is.
That okay.
Speaking of I Am Legend, like the Will Smith one. Woo.
Well, yeah. I didn't hate that movie
as much as a lot of people did, but yeah.
I didn't, but yes, the CG was silly. Everybody can agree on that. But no, I thought that the film itself was fine.
Yeah.
I was fine with him going to and getting angry at poster people in the video store. I mean, it was also kind of on that let's start hating Will Smith.
He had peaked, yeah. It was like that and then Hancock right after. Right. Do you have any other, I mean, you like Omega Man and, what, maybe something more recent?
Well, this is one I'm sure we were both going to get to, but, specifically the Neil Marshall movie Doomsday.
Yeah. Yeah.
That movie I think is, I mean, first of all, it's just a love letter to a lot of those type of films.
Right. It's basically a love letter to every movie from the 80s.
Yeah. And so
that Neil Marshall obviously saw and adored. Including Mad Max.
Yeah. Well, I think the Road Warrior specifically.
Yeah.
But the way he uses it and tells his story and just he still tells a new and modern story with it. Mm-hmm. He doesn't just go into. I don't think he just rehashes everything. I mean, it's a little bit. He's definitely, you know, making homages. But I find the movie pretty thrilling and pretty definitely dark.
Dark, yeah, super violent.
It's a Neil Marshall movie.
Yeah, and I think it was his follow-up, his first follow-up to The Descent.
It was, yeah.
And I don't think it's as good of a movie as The Descent, and I think it's a bit of a mess, to be totally honest. It kind of goes from one thing to another with very little connective tissue. But it's just so much fun doing it. And the movie is so, like, he's clearly, like, he's making the movie like it's the last movie he's ever going to make. And so he's just stuffing it with every kind of fanboy fetish, but which that thing can like be annoying with some people. But I think Neil Marshall, specifically in that movie, does it really well.
My newest reading on it,
mm-hmm.
because I would have said the same thing as you a week ago, but right after I watched Mad Max, I felt the need to watch Doomsday.
Fair enough.
And I actually had a kind of a different take on it. I think that there's this weird thing about. So you've got basically, when you look at the family structure, so you've got the bad guy in it, Saul, and his bad father, and they're both these two, the two bad guys of the film. One is, you know, he's trying to take everything back to the medieval ages, and it's got this really, like, very conservative kind of stances on things. Whereas Saul is like the exact opposite, and he's living in the cities, being very urban, being very, and taking it to the other extreme.
Okay.
And so I think that there's a weird sort of, I think there is something very, there's something commenting very Scottish, left wing, right wing kind of politics about the film.
Hmm. I mean, it's been a long time since I've seen it. It might be worth looking at again.
Well, the first time you're going to lose it because it doesn't really, you're not familiar with the family politics that are going on.
Yeah.
And then this time, I don't know what it was. I was just watching it. I was like, huh. That's weird. Never recognized that before. So maybe it's not there. Maybe it's just over speculation. But I found it much more engaging this time.
Okay.
And I've always loved the film. But I mean, it has some bonkers. I mean, just pure like beautiful scenes.
Mm-hmm.
You get so captivated in some of them. I think you kind of lose the thread of the story.
I don't think I'll ever forget the sequence where the cannibals, the like punk rock cannibals. Like fry up and fillet a dude,
right?
Susie and the Banshees Spellbound.
You know that's exactly the scene I'm talking about. It is a beautiful. It's a perfect scene,
right?
Just from like him going on the stage to it's
beautiful. The editing, the cinematography. Yeah, it's one to check out. Kind of a modern drive-in classic.
Yeah.
I really like John Hillcoat's The Road, which is a movie that I feel is very underrated, and a lot of people kind of give it a lot of shit.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's just not appreciated, or a lot of people didn't see it. But I think it's really moody, it's atmospheric, it plays with these pulpy genres, but takes it, like, basically sucks the fun out of it. Maybe that's why people didn't like it, is they're like, oh, it's Mad Max, only, like, the bleakest, most depressing thing ever.
It's realistic Mad Max, yeah, right?
And that's sort of what I appreciated about it. It was like, we've seen this done as action pulp fodder for so long. Here's a movie that's saying, this wouldn't be cool. This wouldn't be fun. This would actually really suck.
See, I kind of liked it in that sense, too. Mm. But, like, just for the exact opposite reasons. I found that more fun because it's like, yes, let's make it worse.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's an inherent kind of entertainment value in the movie, even though it's much more of a drama than you know, a lot of these movies are. Mm-hmm. But I think that it, you know, there's one sequence in particular that I think is one of the best, like, horror sequences in a movie of the last decade or two. And that's the one where they run into their cannibals, as is a trope in these movies.
Right.
And it's just played so graphically and, you know, not like oversell, like they don't shove the gore in your face, but it's implied in just the creepiest way.
Well, they do show you, but it's quick. They do it so atmospherically. Yeah. They do it so atmospherically and just so.
And Hillcoat is such a good director.
Oh, I agree. I've loved all of his films, really. Mm-hmm. But he, yeah, I could see that one being underrated. And honestly, I don't know what other people's, there were some like book people who had a problem with it.
A lot of book people. Yeah.
I found it very strange because it, there was like maybe like there's one specific scene people were pissed that they left out. I mean, but reading the book, it reads pretty much like the movie.
Mm.
Like,
well, and it's based on the book by Cormac McCarthy. And this was I want to say, the first adaptation of his work after No Country for Old Men.
Right.
So I think there was a lot of expectations there. It was a very highly rated book. So yeah, maybe it was just something that nobody could ever live up to. But
there's one, yeah, the one pivotal scene is it's pretty rough, and it also has to do with some cannibals in the book. But
right.
I don't know, like, they kind of even insinuated in the movie, but...
And you can't have everything.
Well, even if they would have added it, I don't know. It didn't take away from the movie experience, and I'm pretty good at separating the two. And so, I don't know, I found both arguments really lacking that were against the film, whether it was it's not pulp and fun enough or it's not enough like the book.
Yeah.
Because it was a lot like the book, actually, like a lot. So... Mm-hmm.
Do you have any others? Any last ones?
I always like Book of Eli, but...
Yeah, you know, that one...
It was fun, dumb pulp that came out.
Right. I think it's made by the Hughes brothers. It looks amazing. The cinematography is great. It's really, like, desaturated, and there's some great concepts in it. I think
there's some cool world building as well.
Right. I think the main theme of the story is so heavy... that it kind of makes it a little groany. Like, the first time I saw it, I was able to just kind of enjoy it on a surface level. The second time, it was harder for me to kind of get through.
Just swallow. I can kind of see some people's arguments for that, but or including yours. But to me, I'm mostly going for to be in that world.
Right. And the world building and the cinematography and the performances are all great.
Well, that first, like, 10 minutes, too, is pretty great when he's, you know, in this hell, you know, this fallout forest hunting a cat. I mean, that was pretty cool. I'm not going to lie.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and get into it. Let's do it. Let's do Mad Max Fury Road, which is the fourth in the series, directed by George Miller, who had done the other three. But this has had the longest wait between them.
Right.
Mad Max Return to Beyond Thunderdome came out in 85, which was the year I was born, so almost 30 years ago.
It came out in 85? Okay.
Yeah. I know. I was surprised myself. I thought that was like 87, 88, but no, yeah. George Miller's had one of maybe the most eclectic careers of all of Hollywood.
That's saying it mildly. I mean, okay, the Mad Max films, Lorenzo Oil, The Witches of Eastwick, Happy Feet, Babe. Like, I mean, on paper, that just sounds insane to me that that all comes from one person.
Right.
I mean, really.
He's not a real distinctive auteur voice in that way, but he's kind of a get in there and get it done sort of director. But these Mad Max movies have sort of, if anything, have sort of been his place where he gets to really kind of play around and do what he wants to do and right. say the things he wants to say. And, you know, they kind of come out of the tradition of exploitation, gearhead biker movies.
Sure.
Which is more what the first one was. There's kind of a hint toward a post-apocalypse. But they don't really get into that until Road Warrior, where they really, like we said, sort of established the genre.
Where it goes full, yeah.
Yeah, and you have everybody in assless chaps and gay leather gear and driving around in, you know, spiky motor vehicles that are rusted to hell.
Yep. That's the future I imagine for my children.
It's Australia in the 80s. Anything goes. And then, Thunderdome is kind of a madcap, crazy, larger budget, much campier.
It also gets a lot. That is a film, talking about a film that kind of just goes all, you know, because you're established as Thunderdome, and then all of a sudden you're out in this desert with this Peter Pan thing happening in a train, and it goes pretty batshit banana crazy pretty
quick. Tina Turner, yeah.
Yes, Tina Turner. Master Blaster rules Buttertown. Yeah.
And I think this movie, Fury Road, kind of intends to sort of go back to what I think Miller thinks the audiences enjoyed about Road Warrior. Because if any of the movies have really stylistically had a big presence in the zeitgeist or, you know, influence on film in general, it's been that one. But I think this one is more of a spiritual sequel to Road Warrior than anything else. And it's basically a lot like Road Warrior, but everything turned up to 11. And now instead of Mel Gibson, now we have Tom Hardy in the lead. And kind of like the last few movies, he sort of wanders into this situation. He's sort of a man with no name character, really. There's a lot of, as I was rewatching Road Warrior, I didn't realize how much Kurosawa influences in that movie.
Oh yeah, for sure. This is my take on
this
that,
one
though.
Less so.
Yeah, this is my take on the Mad Max character. Mm-hmm. Is Mad Max isn't really a person. He's like a folk hero. Like, like, you know, you talk about, you know, Robin Hood, where it's all these different acts, but it's all attributed to one central character. And that's how I see Mad Max. So he can wander into any situation and be the hero of that movie.
Yeah. And he's usually, I would say, in this movie as well, and maybe especially this movie, the least interesting thing in the movie.
Sometimes, yeah.
He's a lot of the times, you know, he's very much an audience cipher. There is a little bit of that kind of like bumbling guy gets into a situation, has to get himself out again, kind of Indiana Jones-ish kind of thing, but maybe with even less personality or character than that. But basically this story is kind of different than we've seen from these movies and these kinds of movies. And the basic premise is that there's this evil overlord government, as there always is, who's fronted by a evil king of sorts who's impregnating this tribe of virginal women to keep his progeny going. And he's withholding all this water, which is basically like the currency of the future. And he's, you know, holding most of it for him and his kingdom, and obviously not giving it to everybody else. He only let the water flow maybe 5 minutes a day or less. Mad Max kind of gets caught in the situation, and while he's trying to take a vehicle, and he runs into this woman.
Well, he's post-apocalyptic Darth Vader. I mean, essentially.
Right, yeah, he has a breathing apparatus and everything. And then he meets this woman named Furiosa, played by Charlize Theron, who's trying to save these women and take them to a better place where supposed to be greener and healthier earth. Basically everything we've seen up to this point has been desert. So we have no real reason to believe this place might exist other than she says it does. And in the process of stealing this vehicle, he ends up sort of kind of helping them. Mm-hmm. the movie is mostly based around these enormous set pieces. And I mean, you think of like those Rube Goldberg like set pieces that you see in like the Gore Verbinski movies that have like an inciting action that kind of carries out through for like 20 minutes. This right. is kind of like that, but even more so.
Well,
and the stakes are even higher.
And even crazy, and it's crazier, yeah.
Right. So, I mean, I'll open the floor to you. What did you think of Mad Max Fury Road?
Well, it was a badass post-apocalyptic film. Like, I mean, I can't complain. It was exactly what I wanted it to be and turned up to a 12 or 11, like you said. I think it beautifully synthesizes, like, if we're talking about rebooting or recapturing the films, right? Mm-hmm. I think it does it in a good way, because it kind of, it's basically, you know, like the last 20 minutes of Road Warrior, but for 2 hours.
But yeah, you start at that point.
Plus the emotional kind of baggage from the first movie, added the weird, you know, outfits and bungee jumping chainsaw baloney stuff that happens in. So I mean, he basically synthesizes all the best stuff from all three of those films into one fully structured fantasy post-apocalyptic world.
Yeah.
And honestly, that was the best part to me, was the world stuff that he had going on.
Mm-hmm.
The set pieces were a lot of fun. It was big. They had the dude on with the guitar playing. Everybody likes that. Come on.
I fucking loved it.
Yeah.
It was so great.
I mean, it was what you wanted it to be.
Right.
I mean, if you're a fan of this kind of stuff. I personally, I don't know. I couldn't ask for more, really. It is about as good as everybody's saying. It's a big, fun rock and roll opera ride.
Yeah.
Like, that's what it is. Set in post-apocalyptic land. And yeah, it's what I wanted to see. The good guys are good. Mm-hmm. And they're, well, you know, as a post-apocalyptic goes.
Right. I mean, everyone's sort of out for themselves.
it's more the trappings are so, like, everything's so elaborate, and there's such like a, like, you're basically why this film is really fun is because you could read into everything. Like, even these, like, these, you know, the war boys, which they're little praying and all that kind of stuff. It's so integrated into this world that, like, you can read into it however you want. But right. it just plays there, and it's just, it sets up for great scenes.
Yeah, I mean, the overlord, this king, whose name I can't find on here, but
Imotan Joe.
There you go. He's sort of like the leader of like this death cult. And I think a lot of people, it's sort of interesting, and I'm not sure how I feel about it yet, but I think a lot of people are reading a lot into this movie. There's been all these articles written about the feminist allegory here.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw this with a few friends from film school. So that conversation was happening as we were walking out. And I think that's valid, and it's certainly not there. I don't necessarily know how intentional it was, and maybe that's not important.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with this, you know, this, the suicide death cult that it's like chasing them and doing that, you could even read in like maybe a Middle Eastern terrorist kind of, you know, allegory into that, as well as obvious sort of post-Metropolis thing going on with class divisions, so which has been a hot topic in science fiction as of the last few years. So I think, you know, given this movie, which is so fast and just never stops almost, there's a few quieter scenes, but for the most part, it is a train of set pieces.
Going forward and then back.
Yeah, yeah. And exactly. And it doesn't really let up. There is a decent amount of stuff in there, content, if you're looking for it. I also don't think that you'd need that at all to enjoy this movie.
I don't think so. I think it's mostly fun. I have a hard time. Like to me, that's like saying Pacific Rim was about global companies and there's sort of kind of a I don't know, there's too much of the fantasy and the pulp. I don't really buy some of the people saying how much political message is in it.
People who love it for that reason or hate it for that reason.
Yeah, I don't think it's, well, both. I just kind of like, I liked it because it was a Road Warrior movie. It was badass. Yeah. But I don't think that that's a failing or a success. I just think it's there because I think it's mildly informs the type of characters he's put into the world. I don't think it has. If he would have chose different characters or more boring, or he wouldn't have had such depth to the characters, then it would have been different. But it's more people projecting our own psyche onto him. I don't think it's intentionally there. And even if it is, like, it's very mild. Yeah. It's not saying something over the moon, like, important and smart.
Yeah, and I think that was sort of my impression of the movie. I enjoyed it immensely. As an action movie, I think, you know, it kind of does that Gore Verbinski, Rube Goldberg, you know, style of set piecing. And I think it, you know, it kind of has that chaotic everything and jammed in the frame kind of Michael Bay thing. But it kind of does those things the best of their ability.
Well, yeah, again, I think the movie's great. Mm. Absolutely great. I'm not full thumbs up, a billion stars, whatever you want.
And I get that people want to, like, go back and see this movie multiple times, and that they've gotten a lot out of it. And I even understand why some of these articles about, like, especially the feminist context of the movie.
But I kind of feel like this is people's first introduction into this stuff.
I agree.
You know what I'm saying? It's more, or they're rediscovering it. They're like, oh, yeah, it's cool. Whereas people who have already kind of been, you know, really playing in this world for a while are just going to be kind of like, yeah, it was a sweet Mad Max film.
Right. Well, I mean, the conversation I was having with my friends, because they were really kind of going on about this, you know, this down with the patriarchy thing, which that is, I mean, it is there in a way. It's not there, you know, and I think that's a valid read of the movie. But I also say, you know, there's a tradition in kind of pulp end of the world scenarios or whatever, or even kind of old world scenarios like pre-civilization, of the strong female Amazonian tribe.
Right.
That's a thing that's been there for a while. And when that was more the level of what I was reading it as. I mean, yes, the Furiosa character helping these women, and they, you know, there is some stuff in there to suggest that Miller meant maybe a little bit more with it, especially the last shot of the film. But I don't think that it's, I don't see this as a political film.
No, and I don't think, and I think it's mostly a big spectacle. And there's nothing wrong, because this is a spectacle done completely right.
Yeah, it's one that I actually had fun with. I never got bored. The functionality of the set pieces were always, like, I could follow them. I knew where everything was in context to each other. The movie is so brilliantly raises the stakes every single time. Every time you think you've seen the most intense set piece, like, how could they top that? They find some new way of doing it.
They ratchet it up a little bit more.
Yeah.
No, and I mean, again, like I said, like, I like that he has, like, people pulling bullet teeth out of their mouth, and that's the kind of stuff that I think is most impressive about this, is the world he builds, so people can feel like there's all these different narratives going on.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I think that might be purposeful.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it is I think you're right on the Amazonian thing and the down with patriarch and all that. I think that that's a valid read.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the pacing and editing and just getting into the minutiae and focusing on the little parts of this film is really what makes it, like, I think, will fly and succeed in the way it does.
Yeah.
Because I think somebody in lesser hands wouldn't pay attention to those things. And so you couldn't get any of those narratives out of it first. Second of all, you wouldn't build as much of a rich film land to play in.
Mm-hmm.
So I love the film, like, really.
Yeah, I did too. I mean, I just had a blast with it. I do see it more as a technical piece. And I think that the production design and the cinematography and the costume design and the makeup, like, all of that, you know, it's kind of like a big circus.
Oh yeah.
And it's in of the highest caliber. Like, it's sort of interesting. We had this whole discussion about different post-apocalyptic movies. In a way, I kind of feel like this movie is really influenced, not necessarily by the other Mad Max movies, but more by movies that were influenced by Mad Max movies.
Right.
Like, while watching it, I was like, there's even a little Waterworld in this movie. And there's a little bit of Doomsday in this movie. And then there's a little bit of... The Good, the Bad, the Weird. The Good, the Bad, the Weird ends in a big sequence that's very much inspired by Road Warrior. And I feel like Miller saw that and was taking notes on, like, how to make it even more visually intense.
Yeah, I've also heard he was really influenced by Cirque du Soleil, which I think shows.
That's kind of what it's like.
Like, I don't think there's anything wrong with it. That is a spectacle in and of itself.
Right.
But
right.
But to show that in cinema in an interesting way is pretty awesome.
And Nicholas Hoult, who's up to this point, you know, generally played kind of a pretty boy.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe with the exception of Warm Bodies to a certain extent, even though he's kind of supposed to be a dreamy zombie. In this movie, he really like goes for it. Like he's like completely debases himself as a young virile sex symbol or whatever we're supposed to take him as now. There's a lot of weird details in this, like that makes
the spray painting the mouth
right.
To the halls of Valhalla. I'm gonna scream that at people all the time now.
You should just bring a little like Walmart can of spray paint and just like roll down your window when you're at a red light and just do that to the person next to you.
Yeah, just jump on the top of their car. See how they react. Probably get shot immediately. Or tased. Right.
But I think there's a lot of details like that in this movie that keeps, even though it's kind of moving at a clip and it's so big and kind of overwhelming, that keeps the world really grounded and really tangible. Like, I never, you know, there's a few sequences where it kind of goes into CGI land, but for the most part, it always kind of feels like everyone is in some level of pain throughout the movie, and you could feel everyone sweaty and tired and exhausted because of how intense everything is. And there, you know, people are just like spitting blood at each other and spitting gasoline, and the whole thing just feels.
Yeah, it's chaos porn. But yeah. You know what? I mean, that's what I want out of a Road Warrior movie, really. Mm-hmm. I can't complain. No, but I think you're right. There are a few scenes where it gets a little bit CGI-y, but I think in a good way.
Mm-hmm. And it's not like the movie isn't already started being over the top, so.
Well, that's the other thing, too, is he makes no qualms about... That's the thing, if you're going to do this, just be that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Go full. But, like, the thing that I think other films, like, why something like Gore Verbinski's Lone Ranger kind of failed, mm-hmm. is because it had this shifting tone. In this shifting kind of like world,
mm-hmm. it was trying to be too many things to too many people.
Yeah, and this film was just trying to be, you know, the big post-apocalyptic madness that it was.
Uh-huh.
Even if it does have 1,000 different sources and a bunch of different things coming into it, but again, it does further my opinion that George Miller is a crazy person. Like he is not.
Yeah, there is something kind of like pure and unfettered about this. Like this is him with no. Shackles.
Exactly. There's something in him, but I can't, again, it's been a big part of my life for a long time. The other thing I think that's really influenced a lot and people won't talk about as much is Fallout.
Oh yeah.
That was a huge entity that kind of, I think even maybe even got him to be able to get the money to make something this big.
Yeah.
Again, I think that it's a lovely synthesis of all the things that... Mm. And the other thing, too, is we're talking about him being unfettered. The other thing he doesn't do is try to be like, well, I have to be so unique.
Right.
I mean, he is unique, but what I mean is he doesn't have to be like, well, I can't do this because somebody else completely has done that. Right. He's like, no, they took that from me. I'm going to take that from them. This is my toy, too. I'm going to play with it how I want to play with it.
Agreed. I would say, you know... Maybe casting somebody like Tom Hardy in the lead, and this mm-hmm. happens to him a lot, I feel, as an actor. I really kind of wanted a bit more from him. I know that's not necessarily what the character is, mm-hmm. and he is supposed to kind of be stoic and sort of, you know, just a cipher for the audience. But given that it was him, I was expecting maybe a little bit more, and the movie kind of gets taken away from him.
Well, he doesn't. Okay, this is the thing. Is I was thinking about this because there is kind of a chatter about this.
Mm-hmm.
The film isn't about him.
No, it isn't
at all.
I mean, you could honestly, you could leave the Mad Max element out of it and just call it Fury Road, and it could just be a tribute to the Mad Max universe.
Right.
But yeah.
I mean, but at the same, I liked how he was going about the character. And I think that if he had scenes to more kind of chew the scenery a little bit, then we could see something like that from him. Cause I even thought the little, dream sequence things that he was having, they were pretty cool. The first of it was really, really cool. Him getting captured and everything and stomping on lizards and eating them. I gotta say that was a great intro.
That's another, I thought about, the Riddick movies a little bit while I was watching this as well.
Well, see, that's the thing I was talking about. They're already talking about the sequel, which I'm going to get into because it's going to, you know, because it's exciting. They want to, the name is the Mad Max, The Wasteland. And I could watch just hours of him eating lizards and stuff like that. Like that, the last Riddick movie, I was pissed when they went back into civilization. I thought it should have just been him fighting monsters alone on a planet for 2 hours. And so if they're going to do that, I'm fine with that. In fact, that's something that you don't see in the post-apocalyptic narrative a lot, is them get into the more weird fantasy / sci-fi kind of world. And in specifically, I should say, in film. It's happened a lot in books, video games, and other places.
So you want to see them like fight like something more mutant or maybe a sandworm or something.
Like a sand dragon.
Yeah.
It's a giant radioactive Komodo dragons.
I'm down.
That he has to kill with just a small, like, boot dagger.
Well, there is one sequence when they're, like, going through this big marshy area where you see these people, presumably they're people, on stilts. Like, and it's very evocative and creepy imagery, and it has a bit of kind of a mutant-ish vibe to it.
Yeah, but that's what I'm talking about. That's what I want.
Yeah.
Let's get into some of that kind of terrain. but anything that crazy man wants to do, I'll probably at least take a gander at it. So.
So, recommended, I think, from both of us.
Yeah, pretty highly.
Okay, we're going to do it. We're going to, even though we're late into the episode, let's review David Wayne's They Came Together.
Okay.
And I'll let you set it up.
It's a great pairing for this film, too.
Yeah.
They Came Together is, it's got Paul Rudd and Amy Fowler in it, and they're basically...
Polar?
What did I say?
Fowler.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Polar, Fowler. Basically what they do is, it's like a very typical setup for romantic comedy where they're telling their love story, but it's as ironic and gagging that genre as possible, especially the more generic... stupid parts of the romantic comedy film world. And honestly, the gags are funny. They're pretty good, but I overall kind of thought the film was maybe forgettable because it was so much like one of those movies. So I know that's part of the joke. And so it's like necessary, but like nothing made it stand out because of that.
Right. So. I agree with you. I feel like it's sort of one joke writ large.
Right.
Like they take one premise and they really just kind of run with it. And it's funny for about 25 minutes until you get the idea. I mean, occasionally it will come up with a new gag or something that'll make you laugh. But the concept of like, okay, they're going to do this like that, it runs out of steam a lot faster than I think they realized.
Well, also the jokes become a little too cutesy.
Mm-hmm.
Which,
and a little easy.
Exactly. They're just low hanging fruit, which I don't always necessarily, sometimes that's fine, but I guess I just, overall, it's not necessarily the ride that was the problem. Mm-hmm. I laughed and I felt it was funny or whatever for most of the movie, and I got through it. Nothing felt punishing. But when I was finished it, I was like, okay.
Yeah.
Now, there was no like really lasting. It was just a good way to spend an hour and a half if you wanted a good laugh.
Right. It's like kind of the perfect Netflix experiment in that way. Like it's sort of made for a night in with Netflix. It was like no commitment.
Right.
And yeah, so I mean, I think obviously you'll find more to enjoy out of it if you've seen a lot of those Nancy Meyer, Nora Ephron comedies from like the late 90s, early 2000s. Because it uses all of those tropes all the way through. But yeah, and Amy Poehler and Paul Rudd are very likable. Mm-hmm. And they're very good at being complete goofballs and playing something straight.
I could probably watch them have just actual dinner together for 2 hours and be perfectly lovely.
My dinner with Andre style, like Talking Heads comedy. Yeah.
No, I just mean literally them as themselves, you know, just kind of chatting about their day. Oh man, Parks and Rec was so fun this week, blah, 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 you know.
So I enjoyed myself as I was watching it, but I did kind of feel like there was a point in the movie when I kind of was like, okay, so this is what it is. And I think that David Wayne, who directed it, who also did Wet Hot American Summer and Wanderlust and Role Models, there's a little bit more of that kind of laugh-a-minute absurdity from Wet Hot American Summer. Mm-hmm. I maybe could have used more of that. I think one of the best sequences of the movie has to do with, I can't remember the actor's name, or Law & Order, one of those shows.
That makes it even like, you know, hard.
He was also in Harold and Kumar, and he was in Wet Hot American Summer as the cook.
Oh, Chris Maloney?
Anyway, there's a gag with him where they're at a costume party, and it kind of goes to an absurd level, and it kind of goes to that outside of the realm of what the basic joke is of this.
Where he poops in his suit?
Yeah.
That's Chris Maloney, yeah.
Okay, well, I had a lot of fun with that. And I kind of maybe wish there was a little bit more of it. It's fine.
Yeah, that's basically if you want a quick, dirty laugh. I mean, again, and it's not like one of those comedies where you watch it and like you get like two laughs out of it and then you regret it.
Yeah,
like it's literally just like a here and there. It's a Mexican TV dinner. It's very good for what you wanted if you wanted a Mexican TV dinner.
I don't know, man. I've had some bad experiences with Mexican TV dinners.
that's my go-to bad meal that I kind of like.
That's your empty calories kind of thing, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's you know, I think if you're a fan of Wet Hot American Summer and you like that David Wayne style humor, there's enough of it there. I think that movie is quite a bit better. I think Role Models is quite a bit better. But I enjoyed myself mildly, mostly because I just like these actors and they can kind of do anything effortlessly.
Yeah.
Okay, and that does the show. I do have a letter.
Is it all from Patrick?
Yeah, but I left him a pretty good iTunes review for his show, Make Dad Read Comics. Eventually, at some point, we've been asked to participate in their podcast. So.
Oh, this is a different Patrick. This is that Patrick. Okay, I got it.
The other Patrick has never emailed us.
Okay. Sometimes I get confused. We're good.
I haven't even heard from him in a long time. But anyway... Yeah, I left him a good iTunes review, and I think he's talking a little bit about that. And at some point, we are going to collaborate with them on their podcast. I'm not sure what capacity, but we'll find out as soon as my life is more in order. But he says, first off, thanks so much, Cassidy, for the wonderful iTunes review. Richard, a CthulhuCon sounds like a perfect niche convention because of the shared universe and expanded content created by both professionals and fans. I really enjoyed your discussion on canon, fan fiction, and the expanding fictional universe beyond. As a comic book fan for 20-plus years, and unlike you and Richard, a lover of all things James Bond for my own sanity, I have to just create my own headcanon of both mediums. I refuse to mash my teeth when a new actor takes the mantle of Bond and every comic book reboot or retcon. Instead, I just pick parts I like and exclude those I do not, and the rest can exist without ruining the source for me. Sorry for a shameless plug, but I do record a second podcast other than Make Dad, and it is called Almost Educational. I've heard him talk about this on his podcast before. Because he's a teacher in real life.
Oh, but he uses the word education. That scares people. I'm just kidding.
I don't know. Those NPR things are like some of the most highly downloaded stuff.
And oh, no. NPR? No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
he does another podcast called Almost Educational. He's probably going to talk about it in this letters before I try and haphazardly describe what it is. He says, I sit down with my fellow teacher friend Dennis, and we bring a thesis or thought experiment we could never discuss in our classes and talk them to death via podcast. So that sounds fun. I haven't made the jump. There's a lot of people I listen to who do multiple podcasts.
Right.
Because if you can't get anyone to listen to one, why not just start another? But yeah, I haven't listened to his other one. I'll have to check it out.
Those podcasts. I'm so bad about listening to podcasts.
I know. You're as bad at listening to podcasts as I am at watching TV.
Yeah, I know.
I think I'm getting better, though. We did a recent show arguing and debating all types of canon, retcon and reboot, and fictional works. And in a recent episode about James Bond headcanon. So, like, their, I guess, fantasy universe of what they would want for James Bond. He says, awesome shows as always, and about to go for the evening 10K run and listen to the Avengers cast you guys recently finished. So that was our last episode we did week before last with Leland of Dampercast, another pod friend. And if you guys haven't listened to that, it's long. We review every fucking Marvel movie.
That's right.
And yeah, you probably should do a 10K while listening to it.
A 10K? Man, who is this guy? He's educating me, Adronic.
He's educated. He's a teacher. He's a podcaster. He's a geek, and he's also athletic. So, you know, quadruple threat. Patrick and Dad sends his love. Your review was the first feedback he found on his own when he was trying to figure out how we were on iTunes last week. He called me like 3 times at work to tell me he found we had reviews and quoted yours, sir. P.S. Richard, here are 3 spy horror novels. That is one of our favorite subgenres.
Exciting.
So here you go. Here's some recs. Some recommendations. Baba Yaga, a novel of witches in Paris.
Okay. I've actually heard that one.
You have heard of that one? Okay. Mm-hmm. Bitter Seeds and The Rook. I'll text you those. Well, thank you, Patrick. It's a very nice letter. We don't get them very often. We always encourage it. And so if anybody wants to write us anything, you can write something like that, very thorough, and get into one of our episodes and argue with us or compliment us or whatever, recommend. We like that as well. Or you can just leave us a one-sentence kind of thing, like an iTunes review.
Or just, you know, leave a big ranty message about local politics and why you hate your governor.
Right. Something completely non-related. You just forward us other email.
Yeah,
please don't. As much as if we need email, I don't do that. But yes, you can do so at our email, like Patrick did. He found us at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook, like I suggested earlier in the episode, and see news items we post, and we let you know if we're going to take a week off, which is probably going to happen a little bit more in the near future as I'm trying to move and graduate. Our Facebook is facebook.com/jabberpodcast. You can also find us on Twitter @JabberPodcast, all one word. Find us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio and leave us a star rating and a one-sentence review, or even just a star rating. You don't even have to leave a review. You can just, it's like you click a button. Do that. We're also searchable under the Zune and the Windows Podcast Network, as well as Pocket Cast. Those I know a little bit less about, but if you know what those are, you probably know more than me. You can find the movie reviews that I write every a little less frequently for the Idaho State Journal at salafork.reviews.blogspot.com. I also wrote a bunch of reviews for a review writing class that I might just upload to that blog. Why the hell not?
Might as well.
And I still have some content over at the Seattle-based website MacGuffin at MacGuff.in/author/Cassidy, working on a longer piece for my final in that review class. And that might end up on MacGuffin if the rap isn't interested. Read Richard's stuff that he does over at Richie. That's your new name.
I thought you were saying Reed Richards, and I was like...
Reed Richards. Mr. Fantastic. Read his stuff over at his blog, rdwally.weebly.com. Listen to Brad, Amanda, and Alyssa's podcast, Quarter Life Crisis, at quartercrisis.podbean.com. I think they're going to have some stuff up here soon about Mad Max as well. We all saw it together. And be sure to listen to Make Dad Read Comics and Leland's show over in Olympia, Washington, Dampercast. Until then, we'll talk to you next week.
Bye.
See you later.